Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the Russian alien parasite film Sputnik. Basic premise of which is that on a relatively routine space flight, or seems to be, two cosmonauts are attacked, I guess, by something, and only one of them survives, and something comes back with him. It follows in the venerable tradition of other space parasite movies, which we will no doubt go into at some length later on.
Yeah, one of which I'm sure you can already guess. I think the most pithy pitch for Sputnik would be that it's about a more harmonious parasitic relationship than the one that you're probably thinking of. Alien human host parasitic relationship.
Right.
Although still a very disagreeable one.
To say the least. So anyway, we open. That's usually Matt's line, but we open with...
It's episode 51, baby. Sky's the limit.
We can shake things up.
Change the whole rule book on y'all. I'm Jim Smith.
And I'm Matt Gerandese. So we open with the two cosmonauts, as I said, in their pod. They're attached to some kind of space station, and they are undocking. They're in the process of doing that.
Mm-hmm. One of them is staving off space dementia by singing a song to himself under his breath. That was Steve Buscemi's affliction, was it not?
In Armageddon, yes.
Yeah, okay.
He had space dementia. We know this because William Fichtner dramatically announces in a moving close-up, he's got space dementia. So, this movie did not remind, I think, either of us of Armageddon.
No, its movie is powerfully Russian and probably could not be further from Michael Bay if it tried. It has its own like flavor of bombast, but it's
mostly in the score, I think.
Yeah.
Sort of a pseudo Hans Zimmer thing going on a lot of the time.
But it very much does not have the like cheeseburgers and jean shorts and funded by the U.S. government military branch kind of vibe going on.
Right.
Fewer shots of Transformer testicles dangling in the breeze. Fewer shots of John Turturro's bare buttocks.
Yeah. So anyway, the two cosmonauts are going through their undocking procedure, and then suddenly they're spiraling out of control in the outer reaches of the atmosphere. They kind of right themselves at length, but then they kind of see a shadow or something or other on their porthole.
Mm-hmm.
And then it cuts to the heroine of our story, Tatiana Klimova, who is a doctor, some kind of neuropsychiatrist or psychologist, who is going through this disciplinary hearing because some patient of hers was having these psychosomatic seizures that she put down to psychological dependence on his mother or something. And she basically gave him a 1 minute dunking in a pool of water.
Mm-hmm.
And that snapped him out of it, but did not go over well with the mother or her superiors, to say the least. So she's getting read the riot act, and basically her two options are accept responsibility and being fired. Or if you want to fight this, we'll send the file over to the prosecutor's office, and that will be uglier. Meanwhile, from the mezzanine, a sort of spooky apparatchik who looks like Denethor is watching the proceedings, and then stops her as she comes out. This is Colonel Simiradov, who basically offers her this proposal. Come out to my facility. I have someone I need you to
evaluate.
And if you do, I'll take care of the review board. You won't have any more problems with that. And after, you know, some resistance, like, is that a request or an order, etc., she agrees to go.
He has a line that endears him to her, or appeared to, from where I was standing, about how orders don't go over well with highly intelligent people, so he doesn't like to call them that.
Right.
So that indicates he's maybe running a slightly more loosey-goosey operation, at least relative to the chewing out that she just received, you know?
Right.
She might have a little more autonomy where she's headed, or at least that's how he's selling it.
Right. So they take a chopper all the way out to Kazakhstan, and this is where the facility is. Oh, God, I skipped over an entire sequence.
Speaking of Kazakhstan, we get the sense that this has been erected, not the whole building, but like that this operation has been erected kind of on the fly because Kazakhstan was also where the surviving cosmonaut touched down. There's a shot of him, well, this whole little sequence of him parachuting into a field, being found by a local and puking up blood, and his eyes are all black and, red, or it's hard to tell in the dark.
And the other cosmonauts, it looks like his head has been smashed, but later proves not to have been entirely the case. Anyway, that's in between the space sequence and the review board sequence.
Yeah, it's more front-loaded than we let on.
In any case, when the film returns to Kazakhstan, it's when Tatiana and the colonel arrive at the facility. And there we see that Dr. Regal, Jan Regal, is trying to hypnotize the cosmonaut to like get him to recover his memories, because that's apparently the obstacle they're dealing with.
Yeah, he doesn't remember the circumstances leading up to the crash or the malfunction, whatever they experienced.
Right. Basically, the cosmonaut jerks him around and then ends the encounter by saying, like, you know, only strong-minded people are sent to space. I can't be hypnotized. This is a fool's errand. Tatiana watches this whole thing and then goes in and does her initial evaluation, asks him a few basic questions, tests him by giving him what ended up being an incredibly hot mug of tea, apparently, and concludes that he has PTSD. His neural receptors are screwed up and his tactile sensation is weakened. And that, coupled with the amnesia and the circumstances, what they know of surrounding the incident, leads her to conclude PTSD.
Yeah. Dunk him in water for a minute and he'll probably be fine. All in a day's work.
So she is being escorted to some kind of dormitory, basically. She seems to be under the impression that she'll be flying out in the morning.
She is very much alone in that, as you know, the people keep dropping unsubtle hints to that effect. Well, you don't have your visa yet, or your papers, comrade, or whatever.
Cafeteria does 3 meals a day, you know? So it gets to be middle of the night sometime, and she's still awake. She gets a knock on her door, and it's the colonel, who is glad she's still awake, and he walks her back to the observation chamber, where, well, there's no easy way to put this. The cosmonaut vomits up an alien.
Yeah, we watch an E.T. come slithering out of its man cocoon, and it looks modestly sized at first, and then it sort of unfurls itself. It appears to be jellyfish-esque in that there's not a lot of, like, hard bones or even much in the way of, like, really tough sinew happening in there. It's just a very rubbery kind of... Well, it's got these, like, spidery eyes set into a head with like a cobra's hood. It's just like a bunch of different predators, you know, terrestrial predators rolled into one to give you just the instinctual feel bads the second you lay eyes on it.
It's got kind of a Kabutops head.
Yeah. It looked to me like a boogeyman that the aliens from Independence Day would believe in, like folklorically. Like children of that species check under their beds for this thing. It's like a more bestial version of like an Independence Day alien. That's selling it a little short, but that was kind of what I was reminded of. The beady little eyes helped, and the kind of fins on the head.
Right. So this is where Tatiana gets read in to the rest of the details, because this is not news, as it turns out, to the doctor or the colonel. Apparently this happens every night. He vomits up this alien parasite thing. It kind of slithers around for a while, anywhere from an hour 40 to an hour 50, and then crawls right back in again.
Right. Yeah, it's in his body. It's about 30 centimeters across, and then once it gets out, it...
Well, long.
Across
would be pretty fucking big.
And then when it's out, it attains a width and or length of about a meter and a half, apparently.
Yeah. So, basically, she's been brought to kind of help figure out how to separate him and the parasite. because his hormone levels and vitals and whatnot fluctuate based on, you know, this alien's activities and how it's feeling and stuff.
And he recovered from the crash mysteriously quickly, which they attribute to the alien.
Some Wolverine-ass powers of regeneration.
Juicing his system somehow.
Yeah. She starts having these more extensive one-on-one sessions with Constantine, the cosmonaut.
She starts deliberately provoking him. She's trying to get under his skin, kind of not to the same degree that our alien visitant has, but she's trying to like get a rise out of him.
For endocrine purposes.
Yeah, to like make his hormones spike and see how the alien responds or see whether it rears its head under stress or anything like that. She does this by needling him about an illegitimate child that he fathered at some point and has had nothing to do with subsequently, even in the wake of the mother's death, which consigned the kid to an orphanage somewhere.
Yeah, I don't remember if it's right here or if we actually see it a little bit earlier. But it's around this time that we start having scenes cutting back and forth where there is a child in an orphanage.
Yeah, a fairly dingy orphanage from the looks of it.
Well, you know, Soviet orphanages, what can you do?
What indeed. So we get one-on-ones with the two of them and other medical tests. He's a very hardy specimen. He's, you know, doing pull-ups and what have you, is no worse for the wear. He does complain of a slight tickle in his throat, which made me
you have no idea, buddy.
Bit. Yeah, right.
Or maybe he does.
He's then moved into a dormitory of his own.
At her insistence.
Yeah, he doesn't appreciate. He seems to like that even less than the cell, if only because it implies that he's going to be under supervision for a long time.
Right.
That he's going to like remain in their custody for a while, even if it's going to be a little cozier than the 6x6 room that he was locked in before.
Right.
So they give him a TV. He MacGyvers some like rabbit ears with a coat hanger so that he can tune into the local news, where he learns that a hero's welcome is awaiting him once he finishes 3 weeks of R&R. That's the cover story, is that he needs to reacclimate to our gravity or something like that.
Yeah. And also, the other cosmonaut is fine.
A-okay.
Allegedly.
Fine and dandy.
One evening after Constantine has been drugged and put back in the cell, because that is the procedure. He's put in the cell overnight. They don't allow the parasite out into the dormitory.
Yeah, it doesn't get TV privileges. Not yet.
So one night, while they're going through this procedure, Tatiana tries to interact with the creature, sees that it reacts to this toy. It's like a tiny plastic punch me clown.
Yeah, it looks like a Russian nesting doll, but without any nesting elements. It's just the one little matryoshka, I think. I don't know how it's pronounced, but you know, a little like tchotchke of a like a village girl.
Yeah, and it's got like a weighted spherical bottom, so it just rocks back and forth. And apparently this is some kind of personal trinket that Constantine takes to and from space with him. That's a cosmonaut thing, I guess. And the alien appears to react to it. So Tatiana says, okay, I want to go in there.
Yeah, raise the glass, cut to the control room where the colonel effectively shrugs and says, go for it.
The doctor's like, we can't do this. It's ridiculous. We can't do that. And the colonel's just like, whatever.
Yeah, life's cheap in Kazakhstan the mid-80s.
Put on a suit. So she does, and then she takes it in there and kind of sets it out. Creature kind of slithers over and curls up around it. She takes a few tentative steps and then slips on some of its ground slime.
Yeah, and some of its weird secretions. Yeah, lands on her ass, which elicits a more hostile response from the creature. It bites her ankle.
Pretty badly.
Pretty gnarly bite. She's like bleeding like a stuck pig as they like drag her out down the hallway.
They sort of cow the creature with like strobes, basically.
Uh-huh.
Apparently it's reactive to light. So they get it back under control and they get her out of there and bandaged up.
I thought there was going to be more of a to-do about the bite, because I feel like in most Close Encounter movies, if you get bitten by something from outer space, you like grow gills overnight or something like that.
Right.
Or suddenly you can jump 20 feet and see in the dark. But I much prefer this more like, I don't know, mundane kind of, like, you know, right. If you get bitten by a barracuda, you don't turn into one. You know, like, I mean, I think the biggest danger there would be, you know, with an alien bite, is that it would be harboring some weird bacteria that we would have no resistance to, obviously. But even that, it doesn't appear to be an issue.
Or just that it would, like, secrete some kind of chemical compound that would be toxic.
Right, but like a puffer fish, you know, or something like that.
Its blood is made of arsenic or, you know, some shit. But no, she's not much worse for the wear, obviously, limping, but other than that, fine. It's around this time that the colonel kind of shows himself to be not entirely what he seemed.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it is his intention to try and weaponize the creature, basically.
In typical Weyland-Yutani fashion. Although, they probably learned it from the Soviets, not the other
right.
way around.
Right, exactly. Basically, he wants Constantine to be able to control it, and then he can control Constantine, and they can use it against the Americans for peace or something.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of rationalizations for his position. Good for him, I guess.
Tatiana has confronted the doctor, who I think is technically her superior, although she keeps getting away with... this is an alien parasite in me, apparently. She keeps getting away with butting heads with him and, you know, being vindicated over and over again. We cited one example where he's like, no, don't raise the glass. And then, well, I mean, she does get a bite for her trouble, but they learn something.
Basically, he's the chief scientist at this place. And then she's just sort of an independent contractor, more or less. So yeah. She's not really in the hierarchy.
Yeah,
which,
well,
is the problem.
Point being, she keeps contradicting him, and more often than not, her instincts are sharper than his. So they have a very adversarial relationship. She confronts him and says, you've been editing the tapes. There's pieces missing.
Yeah, she spots like a couple of jump cuts.
Splices, yeah. What are you hiding? Because previously he had claimed that the alien subsists on a diet of whatever the cosmonaut eats.
Yeah, like a baby in mm-hmm. the womb. Essentially.
And she calls bullshit on that, rightfully so.
So he's like, okay, I'll show you. So he smuggles her out of one part of the facility in a Jeep and gives her some night vision binoculars while he goes out to this fenced-in sort of cage area where the colonel is waiting. And some guards drag this guy out, gagged and bound. Kind of throw him on the ground. There were a group of convicts that Tatiana encounters earlier on, and the guards just tell her, oh yeah, they're here for hard labor. Turns out they're here for something else also.
Mm-hmm.
The creature slithers out, and after kind of eyeballing the convict on the ground, pounces on it and then eats its brain.
Yeah, it's like a dead space death animation, like really like a over the top body horror where, you know, the head comes off and there's a bunch of just gouting blood. That's unpleasant, all the more so weirdly because she's watching it through binoculars, and so you just see like it's like infrared binoculars, right?
Because
it's
like night vision,
right? Yeah, right, not infrared. So it's all just this kind of, it's just two white silhouettes, one eviscerating the other, which is somehow...
So much worse.
Even more, yeah, disquieting.
Yeah, so she duly vomits in the back of the Jeep.
Whereupon the Dr. Riegel tells her that he's formulated this theory that the creature feeds on fear juice, yeah. Basically. That
cortisol.
That it wants to... doesn't just eat for, it's not like eating meat for sustenance. That's why it's such a showman, you know. That's why it lets its victim see it before it goes in for the kill.
Yeah, the brain will have more cortisol in it if the prey has time to get more afraid.
Right.
After this, Tatiana is not really on board anymore.
Yes.
Go figure. She has a conscience. So she attempts to kind of jumpstart the whole thing by telling Constantine, okay, you have a parasite. There's this creature living inside you. It comes out at night and eats brains.
Yeah, and all of this is done as discreetly as possible, needless to say. Like, and any dissident activity, you know, these characters would be trying to get away with under similar circumstances.
Yeah.
He takes it in stride, thank God. I thought we were going to lose 10 minutes of our lives to him being in denial or... but he's pretty much on board with the idea.
As it turns out, he already knew all of this, pretty much. It's initially revealed that he knew about the fact that he's got a parasite, and then a little bit later on, she discovers that he knew about the people eating also.
Well, their symbiosis, his and the aliens, have developed at this point past the point that any of the scientists had realized, it seems to me. You know, that there's a lot of... It's become sort of a two-way street.
Right. Well, I also got the sense that the implication was that it was kind of always like that, and he's kept a lid on it. Because he says something along the lines of...
I guess it's true about cosmonauts being unflappable.
Right, well, he's trying to prevent getting capped, basically. Liquidated, as they say. Because he quite rightly feared that if he knew all this up front and they knew that he knew, they might decide, oh, well, it's so bad right off the bat. This can't be controlled. Let's just kill him.
Well, it's around this point that the Colonel invokes a pretty scary idea, which is that we don't know if this is full-grown or a juvenile.
Right.
You know, they could have like a baby kaiju on their hands for all they know. So he has not ruled out that possibility.
Yeah, which is, and this is also why they're treating him out in the middle of the Kazakh steppe and not, you know, in Moscow or another major urban center.
So here the sort of skullduggery begins in earnest, I guess. Constantine the cosmonaut drugs his guard and sneaks out of his dorm. He and Tatiana go snooping around. They see bodies in the morgue that his guest has been mutilating, and they get into it a little bit.
Yeah, because this is where she finds out that he knew about the brain eating the whole time.
Right.
Tatiana has figured out why Constantine and why not the other cosmonaut. It's because the other cosmonaut has cancer, and he's got like a kidney tumor that's causing Addison's disease, which is throwing off his blood chemistry and makes him inhospitable to the creature.
Mm-hmm.
So she has an idea to fuck with Constantine's body chemistry in the same way with an injection.
Right, to simulate those conditions for long enough to drive the parasite out.
It'll die, and then if they can get Constantine to a hospital, a real hospital, quickly enough, she thinks that she can save him even after the parasite has died. So that's the plan, more or less.
Last bump in the road before that plan is put into action is that the Colonel wises up to some of her snooping, but not all, mercifully, and gives her a front row seat at the next feeding. Like before, when she wanted them to raise the glass, she tells them to let her in to the holding cell. She goes in, manages to placate the monster temporarily by...
Music soothes the savage beast. Starts singing the creature the fucking song about roses that the cosmonauts were singing in the pod at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, which Constantine has sung periodically throughout the movie. Presumably, if it can manage your stress in outer space, it can also manage your stress when you're playing host to an alien spider snake.
And it nearly works, except one of the two convicts that has been brought in for the feeding gets the bright idea that he's going to try and run away, which draws its attention again.
And its ire.
And its salivating mandibles. And so it goes after him and eats his brain. Go figure.
Eats his brain to gain his knowledge.
So Tatiana enlists Dr. Regal in their escape plan. And first he's like, well, either I didn't know about it or you forced me. So, you know, depending on whether you actually make it or not, one or the other is the explanation.
Yeah.
But then it quickly becomes clear that he's going to have to pick a side.
Yeah, her escape plan is much more balls to the wall than he had reckoned on. She starts by sedating a guard with a needle to the neck and doesn't, like, Metal Gear Solid his body into a convenient...
cardboard box.
Yeah, or a fucking file cabinet or... not a file cabinet, but, you know, a storage closet or something. So you just leave him out in plain view, which gets a ticking clock over this whole operation.
So the doctor, in his one final spurt of bravery, decides, I'm not going with you. I'm going to call the authorities while you're escaping to tell them what's going on here.
Right. So he's doing his whistleblower thing, as Tatiana and Constantine are booking it out of the facility. They get guns drawn on them. They open fire. They both get hit, whereupon Constantine doses with the syringe that she prepared, driving the creature out of his body and into the unwitting arms of a bunch of Soviet soldiers. Yeah. Or have their own spurts of bravery, in a matter of speaking.
Right. You
know, red spurts, you know, just all over the walls and ceiling.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the colonel finds the doctor, who has just finished his phone call, and promptly liquidates him. And on the outside, the alien is pretty well shredded with bullets, and thusly, Constantine is much the worse for wear.
They, at this point, have made it to a truck, and they are some miles outside of the facility. Looks like dawn is breaking. They're out on the road in the middle of the steppe.
Finally, once he belches up some more blood, Tatiana decides, okay, this isn't going to work, not like this. So I can't tell exactly what her plan was in her mind, but she basically just like drags him out of the truck and sits him down.
Spends a lot of this in the road flying by the seat of her pants. Yeah, it usually works out.
And the colonel shows up with a couple of guards and the alien in a box. The plan is to reintegrate Constantine and the alien so they can both recover. Instead, as soon as the box is opened, Constantine reassumes control of the alien through force of will or whatever and kills the guards, gets the drop on the colonel, and half of his head is suddenly missing. Go figure.
Yeah, he's not walking that one off.
Yeah.
So they reassimilate, the two of them. Some cars, I don't know, was it supposed to be like what
it's the agency? Authorities.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was whoever,
basically whoever's in charge,
whoever the doctor blew his whistle at has come a calling and he's come to collect them. She's assuring the cosmonaut that they're going to figure something out, and he basically says that he's already got a plan, whereupon he commits suicide.
Yeah.
More or less in her arms, thereby also, we assume, killing the alien. It doesn't have...
There's no gotcha this stinger at the end of the movie, yeah, suggesting that it's alive.
Right, no, yeah, that's not the note the movie ends on at all. But we also don't get, like, visible death throws. Like, there's no, like, chest burster moment, yeah, where the alien is...
It doesn't get vomited back out of him or burst out of his chest and die. We just assume it's gone.
Goes quietly into that good night.
The coda to the film has Tatiana going to the orphanage to adopt Constantine's child, and we see this child that we've cut to maybe three or four times over the course of the movie, as we said earlier. Only at the end of this scene, we find out that this child, who's also an invalid, by the way, spends most of their time in a wheelchair and then periodically hobbles about on very unsteady legs. We find out that this was Tatiana all along.
Right. So she also grew up in an orphanage. She has been flashing back to her upbringing periodically. And we can infer that this is part of what, A, motivated her to pick at that particular psychological scab. Right. When she was needling Constantine in some of their first sessions together. And then also what motivates her to adopt the little tyke when all is said and done.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's all of Sputnik. So,
yes, indeed.
We'll go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some thoughts afterwards.
Da.
Da.
Я вас раньше не видел.
Меня пригласили, чтобы я оценил ваше состояние.
Зачем они меня здесь держат? Можете объяснить?
Вы вырезали часть пленки.
Надо было мне сразу вам все рассказать.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Мы привезли пассажира из космоса. Он внутри вас.
Я должен иметь возможность уничтожить его, если все выйдет из-под контроля.
Помоги мне, Таня.
Уезжайте к себе в Москву, пока можете.
Мы рискуем жизнью человека. Героя Советского Союза.
Если герой, значит, готов ко всему. В том числе и пожертвовать собой.
Почему я? Прости.
And we're back. So, Matt, what do you got for us?
I liked this movie. When we talked about its level of bombast at one point as we were getting into the plot rundown, it does have a very oppressive, percussive score. A lot of like, dun, 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 you know.
But it's not constant. That's the thing. It's like there are stretches where it'll just kind of burst up.
Right.
And then it'll be very low key for other stretches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first time we notice it, it's when Tatiana is being driven the final leg out to the facility. It's just like two Jeeps flanking a car front to back on this deserted desert highway. And it's, all of a sudden it's bum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, which completely comes out of left field almost.
Yeah.
But in a way that I didn't hate.
I didn't hate it either.
It kind of grew on me.
Yeah, there was one moment. It was after she watches the first feeding through binoculars. There's a shot of rain drumming on the hood of the car. And even the rain sounds like, my God, it never lets up. Although, you know, as my co-host just said, it does let up periodically. So there is room to breathe. But when it goes, it like swings for the bleachers. It's kind of all or nothing. The score, it very much draws attention to itself. And then towards the end, it stops being so harsh sounding and turns more kind of stirring strings. That's more symphonic. I was reminded of the ending of Underwater and what you said about how William Eubank always ends his movies a particular way. And right. I've not seen the other one.
The Signal.
So I'll take your word for it. But this felt very much like that. At the very end, it's the kind of music that's trying to impress something upon you. It's, you know, you've just watched something important, and it's a gamble because if you feel like you just watched a good movie, but not necessarily a very weighty or important one, then it can seem kind of pompous.
Right.
Which this did a little, but I did like the movie, and so I'm not inclined to dock any points for that.
Yeah, it's not like that coming up at the end of a movie that's just shit.
And right.
Like, shut the fuck up. Be over.
Even in like, and I liked Underwater okay, but even there it felt less earned than it did here.
Yeah.
It would won me over less than this movie did.
I would say that's fair. That is an appropriate amount to like Underwater, which I think I more or less said at the time.
Yeah. There's something to be said for there not being like a Soviet T.J. Miller, you know, comic relief character in this movie. I guess would be like a Yakov Smirnov type, maybe. I don't know. So
Sergei is jokes.
It's got, I mean, I said earlier it's not important or weighty. That's not necessarily the case. It does have some thematic heft to it. There's a lot of crosstalk about, the word hero comes up a lot. That's pretty much inescapable. Constantine is constantly saying, I'm a hero. The colonel says as much. Oh, we have to try to save his life if we can. He's a national hero. The people are expecting to roll out the red carpet for him. We can't let our heroes down. On and on and on. And then there's also a lot of talk about cowardice. Tatiana accuses the other doctor of being a coward. There's a lot of talk about how cowardice is characterized in this movie as the tendency to do whatever it takes to survive, which is a very workable definition. But yeah, since they're science-minded people, they talk about it in terms of like evolutionary biology. She likens him to like a bottom feeder, basically. Right. This is when he's still going with the program and participating in the convict sacrifices, you know, around the midpoint of the movie. And then eventually he sacks up and helps with their escape attempt, which I was not expecting. Part of the reason I wasn't expecting it is because the three of them, Tatiana, Constantine, and Rigel, the doctor, fit into sort of a Clarice Starling, Hannibal Lecter, Dr. Chilton triumvirate. Or like he was very Chilton-esque at the beginning because he's constantly undercutting her in a way that makes him look foolish, you know, and vainglorious and not as qualified as he thinks he is.
Yeah, she keeps making snide remarks about him wanting to win a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, and Constantine, who is in most respects nothing like Hannibal Lecter, does think very little of Rigel and says, like, after she gets on his case about his bastard son, He's like, all due respect, send the idiot next time, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
And he occasionally strikes a Lecter-esque pose when he's prowling around his holding cell, or, and you know, he is incidentally cannibalizing people, although it's not really his fault.
Yeah. It's pseudo cannibalism.
Right.
It's not direct cannibalism as such.
So the movie sort of plays into that archetypal Trinity relationship and then subverts your expectations towards the end, which I rather liked.
Yeah.
So I don't want to just write it off as a creature feature. It is very serviceable in that regard, but it also does have this lip service paid to what does it mean to be a hero? What does cowardice look like in practice? And who's the real monster? Which is the most contrived question in any movie of this ilk. But
the real monster is the monster.
Yes.
Yeah. let's not mince words.
You know that Guillermo del Toro didn't direct this movie because the monster isn't likable or pitiable at all.
Right, right.
And there's a human antagonist who is also not really likable or pitiable at all. I mean, the Colonel is straight out of The Shape of Water or any of those movies, you know?
Right.
But the monster is very much a B-movie monster, which is nice, actually, that this isn't yet another, and I like Guillermo del Toro a lot. I'm not knocking the guy. He makes the same movie over and over thematically, but I like the movies that he makes. But it's nice to have a version of this material that isn't like a Beauty and the Beast kind of thing. Where,
well, yeah, del Toro's great. Knockoff del Toro would be kind of tedious.
Yes, it would. I think that's really what I'm trying to say. The monster does not have a cuddly interior once you look past its
slimy exterior.
Yeah, it's loathsome exterior. Despite some evidence to the contrary near the beginning, which I think is more sleight of hand on the filmmaker's part, like when it curls up around the little tchotchke.
Bubble,
yeah. Even when it does that, it does so in the manner of a boa constrictor. You know, right. It doesn't have...
It's got way too much length to curl up like a cat.
Yeah, exactly. So it still
just keeps coiling and coiling.
It still looks
like a snake.
Like a kind of, it's got like a childish air to it, but it also looks like a snake coiling around a mouse or something like that. Its eyes, you can just tell just on a creature design level, it doesn't have ET features anywhere. It's not meant to be at all relatably human. It's got beady little arachnoid eyes that are, at least if you share my phobias, make it completely impossible to ascribe any humanity to it whatsoever. You just want to kill it on sight.
Yeah. I'm also all about the late era Soviet decline vibe.
Mm-hmm.
It's central to the movie. You
know, I think that helps the score not be as obtrusive as it otherwise might have been, because it's in keeping with the like Soviet ethos.
Yeah,
you
no,
know,
I,
of the go big or go home mentality.
Yeah, the thing that kept running through my head after the first few times the bombast erupts was like Soviet futurism, which isn't really a real thing, but that was just the phrase that kept occurring to me, you know, like this is what 2030 would sound like if the Soviet Union still existed.
Right.
Which is a little bit weird because it's, again, it's a period piece. It's set in 1983, late era Soviet vibes going on. But, you know, I'm a Cold War nerd, so I'm all about that stuff. If you've seen Chernobyl on HBO, it's got obviously not the like apocalyptic thread necessarily, or at least not as prominent, except when they talk about the potentiality for a kaiju,
right.
I guess a little bit, but... So more or less without the apocalyptic element, but again, the sort of oppressive Soviet atmosphere decline and apparatchiks lying to one another.
Yeah, and you know, liquidating each other behind the scenes. And I assumed that when the first convict showed up that he was like a political prisoner or something, and that this was going to be even more of heavy-handed, like, anti-Soviet screed than it already is, which is, you know, there's plenty of that on the screen already. But the colonel gets on his soapbox at one point about how they're all murderers and rapists and pedophiles, and, you know, that's why he's...
They're not people, they're fodder.
Yeah, right.
Was his line. Which, again, coming out of the face of a man who looks like... What's Denethor, the actor's
something
name?
Noble?
John Noble.
John Noble, yeah.
He just looks like John Noble.
Yeah, there's no scene of him chowing down on like tomatoes and turkey legs while men ride to their deaths, but that is subtextually very much going on here.
Yeah.
Well, and textually when you're actually watching a Dead Space death animation play out right in front of you.
Yeah, that really is a very apt descriptor for how the brains get eaten in this movie.
Yeah.
It's very much the...
Well, I've played the first Dead Space, and I know you've played even, you know, more of them than that. And so when I saw that head come off, I like felt like I'd fucked up. Like I was watching a game over screen. I felt personally accountable.
Like, oh, damn it, I could have saved that guy.
Yeah, I felt a faint twinge of disappointment in myself, which is a weird reaction to have when you're watching a movie. So that's how I knew that it was reminding me of a video game.
Yeah.
And it is definitely that video game. I talked during the plot rundown about how I like that the alien's saliva doesn't make you grow bat wings out of your head or whatever. I wish it had been slightly more down to earth, and this quibble only comes into play towards the end once the full extent of the symbiosis is revealed, because there are a handful of shots of Constantine. I think the first one I can remember, it might not be the first one, is when he injects himself with the fake kidney cancer concoction. Right. His eyes go black and he goes like, and like roars. I haven't seen New Mutants, but it looks like something that would be in New Mutants, you know, or it looks like it's like a Hulk transformation moment. Mm. And there's another one when he's on the road right before the Colonel bites the dust, where he like opens his mouth and a clicky, shrill, like kind of like creature, like yowl comes out. Mm-hmm. And I could have done without that, because I liked how relatively down to earth the alien was depicted in this movie, but some of the telepathy business between him and the creature skirted the edge of like a superhero origin story kind of visual grammar for me in a way that I didn't like, or like a Blade movie, like a monster in a Blade movie, like a Blade vampire.
Motherfucker's always trying to ice skate up here.
So wasn't wild about that, but that's a relatively minor wrinkle. In terms of thematic weight, I already talked about the interplay between, you know, heroism and cowardice and monstrousness and all of that good stuff. There's also a scene that I found rather affecting, which kind of took me by surprise, because I was invested in this movie, but not necessarily emotionally caught up in it. And then right before they try to fly the coop, Constantine talks about how he doesn't think he's worth saving. He says, "I deserve this." It's because
I abandoned my son.
I abandoned my boy. It's like, because he's not, you know, like a full-throated Daniel Plainview thing. He's much more kind of lip quivering and voice quavering, and he's just kind of fallen to pieces in a much more sort of pathetic kind of way. And she, you know, gives him a pep talk, talks him out of it. But I liked this scene, you know, not just because it gets into like daddy issues stuff, which is always like a heartstring puller, you know, no matter who you are, I would think, but also because it echoes, or kind of actually refutes in an interesting way, an earlier scene where this is right before he drugs the guard and pays his visit to the morgue. She asks him, you know, as a spaceman, do you believe in God? Do you think there's anything up there? And he says, I believe in what I can see. I didn't see God.
It's not Tatiana who asks him this. It's actually his guard. This is also the way he manages to drug
guard. Yeah.
It's because it's a young woman who seems to have a bit of a crush on him, frankly.
Right, which is how he gets her to drink some tea that he has
watched
dosed
the VCR with him.
Yeah. No, yeah, Tatiana is way too no-nonsense to be posing philosophical questions like that, which is a characteristic that they share, her and Constantine, which helps this movie move at a pretty steady clip, even though it's nearly 2 hours long.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, so on the one hand, he sounds like a standard Soviet agnostic or like hardline atheist, and then he starts talking about, oh, I deserve this, and he sounds like he's talking about karmic retribution. Like he's
God's punishment.
Yeah, exactly. And so that it's more affecting because you get the sense that his philosophy has been eroded by this experience that he's been through, which is pretty shrewd writing, I think. So I rather appreciated that. And a little of that stuff goes a long way in a movie like this. I mean, I am perfectly happy to just eat up the genre pleasures of a competently executed creature feature. So if there's a little bit of thematic meat on the bones too, so much the better. It's more than just garnish, but it's always a welcome inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we talked about briefly in the Polaroid episode. I remember so little of that movie already, even though it's only been a few weeks. But I know there was a stretch in our recording where we said basically there was an opportunity for some thematic heft to be added to the film.
Right. If they hadn't bungled the multiple backstories and, you know, this, that, and the other thing.
Right. And we were kind of going back and forth on, well, you know, maybe thematic heft is not what this sort of movie needs. And I, the way I came down on it, I remember, is you could do a little bit. I mean, a little bit is welcome. Right. And yeah, I think that's perfectly true here. Although this is also a movie that was a little bit more suited to thematic heft, so it's all the more appropriate.
Yeah, I liked that it wasn't too high-minded. I was slightly, it was relative to its general reception, I was slightly lukewarm on Arrival. Mm-hmm. I liked Arrival just fine, but first of all, that's another case of having to look past the monstrous exterior to see the more kind-hearted entity underneath,
right?
Which is a little bit been there, done that at this point, as we were discussing. And also, well, actually, it kind of pulls a similar trick as this movie, come to think of it, with the business with the spoilers for Arrival. Amy Adams' son is deceased, I believe, which you don't find out until the end.
Yeah.
It's to do with some stuff presented non-sequentially that you don't realize is being presented out of its actual chronological order. Memories are sprinkled throughout the movie in such a way that it looks like it's happening concurrently with her being on assignment, trying to crack the alien language.
Well,
and
there's
that.
Also some general fuckery, and this goes back to the short story the movie's based on, where, like, non-linear time.
Right. Like, the aliens don't perceive time linearly, if memory serves.
Yeah.
You don't have to scratch your head about that kind of thing in this movie because the alien is a spider snake. It seems to experience things more or less the same way we do.
Right.
Just with more of a fear boner, you know, than even the most bloodthirsty human. Where was I going with this? Oh, so there's that weird commonality with the flashbacks in this movie to do with the child in the orphanage were actually flashbacks that were not happening concurrently, which we did not realize. So that payoff is less of a bombshell than it is an Arrival, obviously, but it kind of pulls a similar trick on us there. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's this idea that, like, big budget, and maybe this is less of the case in Russia than it is here, I don't know, but there's this notion that high budget sci-fi also needs to be kind of like art house high-minded sci-fi.
The last, like, 10 to 15 years in particular, obviously 25 years ago, high budget sci-fi was Independence Day. So
you're right.
And shortly thereafter, Armageddon.
Yeah.
But yeah, of late, that's definitely true.
Yeah. And I just I don't know that that necessarily needs to be the case. I mean, obviously, science fiction, especially to do with life beyond the Milky Way, is naturally makes you think along kind of grandiose lines. What is our purpose? What is our place in the universe? That kind of thing. But there are occasionally more pressing concerns when the alien has hostile intent.
Right.
And that's one of the many, many reasons why Independence Day is such a dumb movie, a fun movie, but a dumb one, is because there's no time to dawdle when whole cities and landmarks are being wiped off the map, you know?
Right.
And the alien in this movie is every bit as hostile as the ones in ID4. So,
yeah, it just doesn't have a fleet of enormous spaceships
right
to blow up the White House.
So if you like your alien close encounter movies a little less Carl Sagan-y, Sputnik might be up your alley. And I don't want to badmouth Carl Sagan in particular. I actually like Contact quite a bit, the movie.
Billions and billions. a phrase that he apparently never said in Cosmos, but I will never believe that.
Yeah, it's one of those classic misheard lines, I think.
It's a Mandela effect.
Exactly, but like a very benign one. So yeah, I mean, it's just it's not cuddly. It's not clad in a sweater. The alien does not want to be our friend.
Yeah. I think this is an opportune time to segue into a new segment that we're rolling out here. Now that we've crested the 50-episode threshold.
Oh, yeah. Throwing out that rule book. You thought I was full of shit, but watch out.
We're rolling out a new segment here on the Shock Doctors podcast, and basically it's just recommendations for similar movies, either if we didn't particularly like the movie we watched, recommendations for movies that might have done some of the same things, taken the same ideas in better directions, done them better, or, you know, if we do like the movie, as we did with Sputnik, just other movies that are kind of that ilk that we also like. Obviously, regular listeners of the podcast know that we've done a lot of this sort of informally, scattered throughout previous episodes, depending just on our whims, I guess. But from now on,
we're just flexing our movie muscles, really. Movie buffs do that, I think, chronically to try to justify having seen so many of the damn things. We're always connecting dots, whether or not you asked.
But now,
this reminded me.
But now we're going to do it deliberately in every episode, regardless of whether you asked for it. I'll give you all a hint. Nobody asked for this.
Right.
But we're giving it to you anyway.
So obviously, this movie, like others of its ilk, exists in the shadow of Alien and the whole Alien franchise. Underwater got knocked a lot for just being an Alien derivative, which I think was fair enough, I suppose. Although it's weird because creature-wise, this movie is way more Alien than anything in Underwater. But Underwater, it was like ubiquitous. The reviews all said Alien knockoff, Alien knockoff. And I haven't been seeing that as much here, despite the fact that it's literally a chest-dwelling parasite, you know, that looks kind of Giger-esque once it slithers out of its human suit.
Right.
So it just shows that execution is everything. I mean, that's what I'm always coming back to, that you can kind of steal from the best and no one will accuse you of plagiarism so long as you invest enough of yourself into it, throw in a couple curveballs and just do it with sufficient panache that nobody feels like you're the delinquent student copying someone else's notes.
Mm-hmm. Another movie that I liked reasonably well, I think I might have liked Sputnik a little better. Obviously, I liked Alien a lot better.
Sure.
You know, it's fucking Alien.
Yeah, you've definitely seen Alien, Aliens. If you haven't, it's one of the all-time great double features. You know, set aside a whole ass evening for it.
Yeah, I mean, the first Alien is probably my top 10 movies of all time. So
it's up there.
You know, it's great.
Top 100, incontestably.
But anyway, a movie that I still liked relatively well that touches on some of the same things from about 3 years ago, it was called Life.
I have not seen Life, so this is going to be an instructive segment for yours truly as well. And hopefully I can pull one over on my co-host every once in a while, too.
Yeah, we will certainly find out. But yeah, it's basically kind of an ensemble piece, much like Alien is, and this is less so. Yeah, it's got Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal and Rebecca Ferguson, Hiroyuki Sanada, and just, you know, a bunch of relatively well-known actors, and they're all astronauts on a space station, and there's this sort of parasitical black ooze creature that they find on some kind of abandoned satellite or some such thing, and then they bring it on board their vessel and it gets loose and starts rampaging. Basically, it's much more of, in that way, it is much more like Alien than this is.
Uh-huh.
Because Alien is basically, and this is not to knock it, because again, I don't need to recapitulate my love for Alien once more, but when you come right down to it, Alien is a slasher movie in space.
Yeah, well, and it's famously, it hits a lot of the same beats as a B-movie from the 50s called It, The Terror from Beyond Space, which is, you know, a wordier, clunkier, like less elegant title, but the premise is more or less exactly the same, just without the parasitic wasp angle. That was a real innovation.
Right.
On the screenwriter's part. And then obviously Alien was also had a lot more money thrown at it, and it was, you know, directed superlatively.
Right. So Life is very much like that, in that kind of one by one the parasite gets them, and obviously that's not really how this turns out. One by one the parasite gets guys, but they're not characters with names. They're just much though we might disagree with the colonel, in movie terms, they are just fodder.
Yeah, they might as well have been listed that way in the credits.
Fodder one, fodder two.
Yeah.
My fodder was it.
My fodder worked for the circus. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought of a movie while I was watching Sputnik that I had not thought of in several years. You and I watched it together when it was relatively new. And unfortunately, it's a slow burn and it's a stealth Alien creature feature. It doesn't really come across that way by design for much of its runtime, and so there's unfortunately no way for me to be coy about it. I
feel like you're being coy right now. I don't
about to come right out and say the name. Okay. So it's not really a spoiler warning, because there's no way to, anyway, the movie is Honeymoon.
Okay, yeah.
It's about, you know, a man and a woman, 20-somethings, who have gotten hitched and have gone to a secluded cabin to spend their honeymoon together. And she just starts behaving really erratically, having bouts of amnesia, getting combative with him. And it's just sort of it's like a domestic drama for a long time that just makes you really uneasy. And then gradually the true nature of her affliction kind of becomes more apparent. And there is like Arian, my God, there is an alien parasitism element to it. I am going to try to be a little bit coy about what that looks like, what it entails. But I will just say that, you know, I said that Sputnik was relatively grounded in its depiction of alien life. The Honeymoon is like really creepily plausible in terms of how it plays out. I found, and maybe that just comes down to like the mumblecore influence, you know, that it feels like you're really watching a feuding couple.
Right.
For 90 minutes, try to grapple with something unknowable. But if you watch Sputnik and, like me, thought that I could have done without the black eyes and the yowling, you know, the like more mutant X-Men stuff, Honeymoon might be the movie for you, because it is extremely down to earth. And even when it goes full blown UFO close encounter, you know, towards the end.
Right. Well, yeah, so watch Sputnik if you like Sputnik and you somehow haven't seen Alien or the rest of that franchise.
Yeah, treat yourself.
Get on that shit. And then, Life and Honeymoon, both also good films for you guys to check out. So without any further ado, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Jim Smith. Episode 51, Nowhere to Go But Up.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Sputnik Official Trailer 2020 Alien Horror Movie, uploaded by Movie Trailer Source. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, September 27th, and we'll be discussing The Rental, a slasher movie for the Airbnb generation.